Welcome, everyone, to our second session with Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman on Everyday Ethics. And just a reminder, if you miss a session, you can catch it on the church website. The recording's there, and it's pretty easy to find. And now Derek will open us with prayer.
Morning and welcome, or welcome back if you were here last week. We'll pray again the prayer that I've prayed with my two sons since they were wee little boys, and that they now, I think, probably only begrudgingly tolerate when they're tall as me, teenagers. But let us pray. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. Today, we continue our seminars on living faith, everyday ethics for ordinary Christians. Our topic today is justice, order, and peace in a world at war. This week, we turn our attention to the ethics of force, violence, and killing in warfare. Let me say loud and clear right at the start, we will only be able to skim the surface of these complicated and conflicted issues. We'll sketch the broad outlines of Christian thinking about violence, force, and killing in warfare, and we'll give you a rough sketch on some of the more important points. But we certainly will not be able to delve into all the depths of the two most relevant present conflicts that you see here on our screen, the wars in Ukraine and Israel. While things are relatively straightforward in Ukraine, they are anything but in Israel. Last week, we said that ethics involves the description and evaluation of human action, and that evaluation depends heavily on description. If we can't get our facts straight, if we can't get an accurate and reliable picture of how things stand, we won't be able to arrive at fair and just evaluations. To say that the descriptions of the war in Israel are contradictory and contested is a gross understatement. They are a hot mess. They partake of the general polarization of our historical moment. They are prone to charges and countercharges of fake news and propaganda from one side to the other and back again. Both sides tend to engage in one-sided extremism. Those who support Israel tend towards offering an all bets are off, carte blanche, free pass. Those who support the Palestinian cause tend to stand for an all bets are off, no holds barred by any means necessary. As we'll see in a moment, neither of those extremes have anything to do with Christian thinking about these matters. Again, both sides, those who support Israel and those who tend to support the Palestinians, fail to make distinctions or concessions. For example, those who stand with Israel don't distinguish between the, in principle, just combat actions of the IDF in Gaza and the vigilante violence of settlers in the West Bank. They don't concede that as the war has dragged on, later and recent operations may not pass muster when it comes to proportionality and collateral damage. Though to be fair, both the general public and a fair few pundits don't quite understand how proportionality works in just war thinking. It's similar on the other side of the aisle for those who support the Palestinian cause. They tend not to distinguish between rightful claims for independence and savage terrorism of Hezbollah and Hamas. They fail to concede that free Palestine is a legitimate plea for liberation, whereas from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free is a genocidal cry for extermination. And for all their talk of occupation, there's never a word about the Egyptian occupation of Gaza and the Jordanian annexation of the West Bank from 1948 to 1967, 2 decades in which the Palestinians could have been allowed to establish a state of their own. All of this is to say that it would take hours, maybe even days and weeks, to disentangle all these conflicting descriptions, to even approach the place where we could make an evaluation. That perhaps disappoints your expectations for this morning. If it does, I'm sorry. But it does point up Ethics Lesson 1 from last week. Again, ethics as the description and evaluation of human action in which evaluation depends so heavily on description. So for the moment, we'll have to bracket most of that and press on. Now, when I teach this topic at the seminary, I do one of two things. I teach an entire 13-week course called War and Christian Conscience. And when I teach the intro course, I teach a 4-week sequence where we begin with force, killing, and murder, proceed to war and peace, and then turn our attention to terror and torture, and finally colonization and liberation. This morning, we'll do a brisk survey of those first two: force, killing, and murder, war, and peace. But as you no doubt have noticed, neither of those is the title of our conversation this morning. It's not called War and Peace. It's not called War and Christian Conscience. I've instead framed things in a slightly different fashion, as justice, order, and peace in a world at war. Anyone have a guess, a wild speculation, or a wise observation why we might want to frame matters this way this morning? Yes, no, maybe so. No brave souls. All right. It goes back to week one in our first foray into ethics. And we said that ethics is the description and evaluation of human action. And we begin our descriptions by identifying the ends and means of a human action. The ends are the things we want to get or the things we want to get away from. And the means are just how we get that or get away from that. We further specify those ends in terms of their practical goodness, their desirability. Conversely, we can specify our ends negatively, their undesirability, what we want to get away from. We also said, following Thomas Aquinas, that some of the most fundamental goods that humans desire, some of the things that we want most, are self-preservation, protecting our lives, and species propagation, protecting our children. Both of these desires push us together into mutual association, different forms of society. Now, with war and political violence, it's not just biological life, our lives and the lives of our children, but our way of life that are under threat. Each side wants to preserve itself, me and mine, from threats real and imagined, from thee and thine. What we want to get is life, safety, and security. What we want to get away from is death, danger, and damage. So it's not just life, but our way of life that's up for grabs when push comes to shove and war breaks out. We can examine this threat to our way of life, our society, our mutual association, in terms of justice, order, and peace. However, upon even a cursory examination of those three, we see that the aesthetically pleasing sequence of justice, order, peace, where the two-syllable words come first and the one-syllable word comes at the end as a sort of period, isn't the way that they exist in our experience and in how we understand their significance. The real sequence is order, peace, and justice. Why is this the order of operations, so to speak, when it comes to our experience and the significance of these three social goods? Yeah.
You can't have one season.
Good. There's a sort of aggregate building up. It's hard to have justice if you don't have peace. It's hard to have peace if you don't have order. That's exactly right. Number one answer there on the board, A plus. Well done. Think of places where society has broken down. Regions that are beset by factional infighting. Darfur in the South Sudan, Syria, Yemen, Myanmar, places like that. Or states that have failed altogether where there's no rule of law or really any rules at all. When conflict erupts, order breaks down, and violence sets in, we tend to trade a measure of justice for measures of peace and order. Sometimes these trade-offs are small and subtle. Other times they're fairly radical and unrestricted. In well-established democratic societies like ours, these trade-offs usually are regulated by statute. We have emergency powers that are limited in scope, what can and can't be done, and duration for how long they may be exercised. Think back to the pandemic. Our lives were under threat, and we thought the lives of our children, though it turned out that they were far less susceptible than those of us who are older. And in so doing, our way of life was under threat. In order to protect ourselves, protect our loved ones, protect our neighbors, we traded measures of justice, civil liberties, freedoms, prerogatives that we normally wouldn't allow anyone to tell us what to do about. We closed schools and churches and workplaces. We wore masks. We stood 6 feet apart. We took tests and we got vaccines. We traded a measure of safety, life, for some measure of our usual liberties. In other societies where democracy is more precarious, these trade-offs can be more severe. They can involve major repression or even suspension altogether of civil liberties. Even so, I can't vote, or I vote in elections that I'm pretty sure are a sham, or in elections where there are three candidates, but they're all from the single same party. I may pay a 60% marginal tax rate, but at least all the violence has stopped. The government prevents all the raiding, raping, and rampaging that have been part of our recent history. It may be a devil's bargain, but we make it all the same. Better to be more safe and more secure, if perhaps less free, than to be dead or worrying about being dead all the time. I frame things like this because I think we often approach these matters as a simple binary choice between war and peace. Sign the ceasefire, stop the fighting, bring the troops home. Of course, those are our ultimate goal in these matters, the highest proximate end that we seek. However, should Ukraine surrender and leave Donetsk and Crimea in Russian hands, abandoning their fellow countrymen to the invaders, trading land for peace? Should Israel stop its war short of final victory, leave Gaza, leave Hamas in place to reconstitute itself, to rearm, and await the next attack? Yes, we ultimately want peace. And yes, we sometimes trade justice for order, but at the center of the philosophical, political, legal, and theological traditions of thinking about warfare is the word justice. It's right there in the title, Just War. But let's begin at the beginning with how these issues arise in the first place. The ethical and indeed theological question of force, violence, and killing arises from our practical experience of the human condition. Elizabeth Anscombe, pictured here on the slide, is the most important philosopher of human action since Aristotle and Aquinas. She was also the leading just war thinker of the last century. She puts it like this: since there are always thieves and frauds and men who commit violent attacks on their neighbors and murderers, and since without law backed by adequate force, there usually are gangs of bandits, and since there are, in most places, laws administered by people who command violence to enforce the laws against lawbreakers, the question arises, what is a just attitude to this exercise of violent coercive power on the part of rulers and their subordinate officers? Insofar as these problems and challenges are unavoidable, the presence and persistence of violence and injustice, and such solutions and responses are indispensable, we cannot avoid the question of coercive power, of physical force, even lethal violent force. We have to ask ourselves this question that Anscombe raises. What is a just attitude toward all this? Not just on the part of our rulers and their subordinate officers, but for those of us who live in democratic societies, for ourselves, insofar as at least in principle, our rulers and their officers exercise such force on our behalf and in our name. What do you make of Anscombe's statement here? Is she factually accurate, or does she paint too dark a picture of the world? Is she morally and politically valid to say that we need laws and force to back them? Is she theologically correct? Yeah. First thought, what do you think?
I'm going to get myself into a lot of trouble here.
Good trouble, though, right?
Her problem is Jesus.
Okay.
And our problem is Jesus.
Okay, say more.
Jesus would never advocate for a war, you know, a just war. Nor would he seem to be advocating a defensive war. He didn't defend himself.
Good.
In the world that we understand it to be, there's always violence, there's always injustice.
Sure.
So defensive war seems to be our backdrop. You know, when Hitler was taking over everything, we had to go in there. Would Jesus have said, yes, you got to go to war? He never did it in his lifetime. So he is our problem.
Okay.
If we're Christians.
Excellent. I promise I didn't pay him. That's the very next set of slides. So very well done. Other thoughts about Anscombe's initial observation? Fair enough. As a matter of fact, as a matter of description, I don't think we can argue with her. Look at the news, look at your phone, look at the paper, look at the website, and we do see violence and injustice all around us. The question becomes, how should Christians think about this? How should we act and interact in the midst of all this? But as we've previewed last week, and as you just so nicely set us up to say, the fundamental confession of Christian faith is Christos Kurios, Jesus is Lord. Which raises the question about the relationship between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this world. Whether love of neighbor permits or maybe even demands that we take up arms and exercise force in defense of the weak and the innocent. Or as you said, the problem with Jesus, that enemy love prohibits any exercise of force whatsoever. To answer these questions, we'll first turn to the text of Scripture. Since we're pressed for time, we won't be able to explicate each and every one of them, although we will be able to enumerate the relevant passages. We can start with those that run in the direction of peace and nonviolence, our little dove here on the screen. In the Mosaic Witness of the Old Testament, we begin with the saga of Genesis. In the beginning, God. And in those first three chapters of life in the pristine garden of evil, there is no killing. Not even the killing of animals for human sustenance or the predation of animals on one another. I had a roommate in college who was a bit of a hippie who had a poster that said, God intended to live in a garden with a bunch of naked vegetarians. So in the first three chapters, in the very beginning of the world that God makes, we don't have any violence or killing. Of course, come chapter 4, we get the sad episode of Cain and Abel, the first homicide, the first fratricide, and we're off and running in a history of violence. Bless you. In Exodus and Deuteronomy, we get the Decalogue, the two statements of the Ten Commandments that tell us, thou shalt not retsak. I leave the Hebrew word untranslated for the moment because, as you no doubt know from your own study of Scripture, sometimes your Bible says, thou shalt not kill. And in other translations, it says, thou shalt not murder. Pretty big difference. Wilma Ann Bailey, a Mennonite Old Testament scholar and one of my beloved undergraduate teachers, has written a whole book on this question, whether it should be you shall not kill or whether it should be you shall not murder. Now, sometimes differences in biblical translations don't make much of a difference. This one, I think, makes all the difference. If it's thou shalt not kill, then it's nowhere, no how, no one, no way. If it's thou shalt not murder, then it's only certain killing that is prohibited. Bailey catalogs some 13 occurrences of this word in its different forms across the Hebrew Bible. 4 come in lists of prohibitions, including the 2 iterations of the Decalogue, thou shalt or thou shalt not. And in these texts, it could go either way. It's not obvious from the immediate context of the passage whether it should be kill or murder. There's one where it's very clearly killing rather than murdering, because the thing doing the retzaking is a lion. And a lion is not a moral agent and therefore cannot be guilty of murder. There are 3 more occurrences in relation to the cities of refuge. If you recall, the cities of refuge were established by law in Israel. If someone kills someone else, the killer could flee to the city to run from the family who would avenge the death of the one who had been killed. These weren't sanctuary cities per se. It wasn't a get out of jail free card. It was a pause. So if I kill your brother and you come after me as family honor demands and I make it to the city, I'm safe, but only until the case is adjudicated. The magistrates would ask, was it an accident? Did something weird happen and, you know, your brother was dead and I did it, but I didn't mean to. We were working in the fields and something went awry. Or did your brother attack me and I defended myself, in which case it would be self-defense. If, however, it turned out that it was, in fact, an unjust killing, I killed your brother because I was mad or I was trying to take his ox or some such, then it would be unjust killing. And the person would either be turned over to the family avengers or put to death by the city's magistrates. So in that context, retzach means killing because the context is a homicide that is yet to be adjudicated. There's another one in which it's very obviously murder. The story of Naboth's vineyard. Recall that King Ahab coveted Naboth's vineyard. He went to him several times to try to buy the vineyard, to trade him for a better vineyard, to give him 10 vineyards for his 1 vineyard. And Naboth said no, because that was his family's land. It's not tradable one for another. Ahab returns to the castle, sulky and depressed. Jezebel, the queen, says what's wrong. He explains. And either she herself, the text is ambiguous, or she at Ahab's direction, or she exercising Ahab's authority, has Naboth killed so they may possess the vineyard. Killing in the service of stealing is quite clearly murder. There are 4 other instances in which the circumstances are similar. The killing takes place in the context of injustice, the characteristic oppression of the widow, the stranger, and the orphan, in which case it's most likely that in those texts we should render it murder. Now, on the basis of this evidence, Bailey, again, who's a pacifist, argues for a restrictive translation of the Decalogue as thou shalt not kill. As much as I love my old teacher, I think she's wrong. On balance, it's a 5-4 split decision. 5 are obviously murder, 4 are obviously killing, 4 are up for grabs. But in the wider contextual, canonical, and theological context, I think it's implausible to say that the central law of Israel would issue a blanket prohibition against all killing, nowhere, no how, no way, no one, and then in its subsidiary laws have capital punishment be the consequence for violations of the law. So therefore, I think we do best to render thou shalt not retzach in the Ten Commandments as thou shalt not murder. What else do we find in the Old Testament? Well, throughout the prophetic witness of the Old Testament, we find admonitions to nonviolence and messianic eschatological anticipations of peace and reconciliation. Isaiah and Micah alike tell us that in the end, we will study war no more. Isaiah also paints that picture of the peaceable kingdom where the lion lays down with the lamb and the child plays on the den of the snake, and no one is harmed. And Joel has that famous line about us beating our swords into plowshares. Updated for modern times, we will turn our tanks into tractors. The weapons of war will become implements of agriculture. In the apostolic witness of the New Testament, at the center of things, as you mentioned a moment ago, we find the life, teaching, ministry, resurrection, and crucifixion of Jesus, who, as you said, when captured and arrested unjustly, when convicted falsely and treacherously, and when tortured and executed, lifts not a single hand. Just before his arrest and the temptation in the wilderness, the devil says, "Call down the hosts of heaven and establish your kingdom using the armies of heaven." Jesus declines. And all four gospels tell us that strange little story about that moment in the garden where Peter slices off the ear of the high priest and Jesus rebukes him. We also have the explicit teaching of Jesus, particularly those passages in the Sermon on the Mount. The turn the other cheek, don't avenge yourself, love your enemy, don't overcome evil with evil, but overcome evil with good, which Paul reprises at the end of Romans 12. And finally, in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, we have the War of the Lamb, the final cosmic conflict between good and evil, in which the victor of that war is not the Lion of Judah, the symbol of the Davidic monarchy of messianic might, but it's the Lamb who was slain who overcomes through his own death and suffering. Questions or observations about these texts on the pacifist, nonviolent side of the scales? Turn our attention to the other side of the ledger in a moment, but yeah, back up front again.
I think, would we call Jesus a pacifist?
That's the question, right?
And if Jesus is a pacifist and we're Christians, how could we be otherwise?
That's the question.
It's a question, it's a problem.
Yeah, we'll turn our attention to that problem in a moment.
I'm not happy with it. the president would say, I'm not happy with it.
we'll see if you're happier in a few minutes. Again, you've anticipated where we're going. All right, we'll turn our side to the other side of the ledger in the account. The just war side, represented here by our little hand grenade. In the Mosaic and Davidic witnesses of the Old Testament, we find in Exodus an instance of divine violence. As God frees Israel from their captivity and bondage in Egypt, the firstborn sons are killed by the angel of death, and Pharaoh's armies are overwhelmed by the sea. Following that, we have the conquest narratives of Joshua and Judges, in which Israel enters into the promised land. And following the establishment of the Davidic monarchy, we have the texts of the Davidic Wars in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. In the New Testament, we have another instance of violent prophetic action by Jesus himself. Matthew and Mark both relate the story of the cleansing of the temple. Jesus turns the tables of the money changers, makes himself a little whip of several cords, and drives them out aggressively, shall we say. There's also what some have called the quote-unquote awkward presence of soldiers in the New Testament. We have the healing of the centurion's servant in Luke and Matthew. The centurion comes and says, "Heal my servant." Jesus does so. We have the crucifixion itself in Matthew 27, where one of the soldiers who had just put Jesus to death says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." In Acts 10, we have the conversion of Cornelius, the centurion, and his whole family, who are baptized and receive the Holy Spirit. And in Luke 3, we have soldiers coming to John the Baptist. In these several anecdotes, we have soldiers present amidst the mystery of Jesus and the early church. They receive blessing and healing. Some confess faith. Some even convert and are baptized. And not once does anyone say, "Lay down your arms." Jesus doesn't even tell the centurion the usual, "Go and sin no more," that follows so many of his healings. So the argument here, and it's up to you to decide whether or not it's plausible, is that if Jesus really were a pacifist, if he was really certain and insistent that we should be nonviolent, Surely he would have told these soldiers at least to go and sin no more, or more likely to lay down their arms. But he doesn't, Peter doesn't, no one does, John the Baptist doesn't. There's also that cryptic moment in some of the passion narratives in Luke 22, where Jesus tells his disciples to get a sword, a cloak, and swords. They rummage around and they say, here are two swords, and he says, that is enough. Enough for what? The text doesn't say, and it's hard for us to say from the context. Last but certainly not least is Paul's admonition in Romans 13, which curiously follows his reprisal of the enemy love stuff in Romans 12, where he tells us we must submit ourselves or be subject to governing authorities, that if we resist the governing authority, we are resisting God because those authorities are ordained by God. Why? To do good to the good and to execute wrath and vengeance on the wrongdoer. If you're interested in a full weighing of these matters, there was a long and strong debate between Richard Hayes on the left and Nigel Bigger on the right that lasted from the late 1990s through the mid-2010s. They each have a book, one defending nonviolence, one defending just war, and they exchanged a series of rather aggressive rock'em sock'em robot articles in the time in between the books. So if you're interested, I can give you those citations later if you really want to see a point-by-point rendering of those cases. But for now, how do you weigh this scriptural evidence? By show of hands, anyone persuaded by the pacifist side of the scales? You seem maybe persuaded, or at least you're raising the point. Okay. No. Okay.
Of course. Stop joking.
Okay.
That's not something I can get from Jesus.
Okay. You find this side of the ledger persuaded?
Well, I want to.
Okay. Easier said than done?
Yes.
Yeah, Ted.
Are we allowed to resist the binary?
You can do whatever you want. It's an open conversation.
My vote is neither.
Okay, we'll circle back to that in a moment. I'd like to hear more. Do you have a thought?
Comfortably, I find myself uncomfortably in the middle.
Okay. All right. Other side of the ledger on the balance. Anyone persuaded that the just war texts outweigh the nonviolent pacifist texts? Everybody's somewhere uncomfortably in the middle, it seems. All right. On balance, the historic traditions of Christianity have sided on the just war side of things. Overwhelmingly, but not unanimously. From the earliest Christians through the churches and Christian communities we have today, there have been always those who, you know, have bumper stickers that say, you know, when I said love your enemies, I meant that. Jesus? Yeah.
Go to war, but I can't claim Jesus as my.
Okay. All right. Fair.
Now, could you repeat that for the folks online?
Sure. He said that he went to war or would go to war if the cause was just. Paradigmatic instance, Hitler's aggression in Europe and around the world. But he would do so knowing that in some sense he couldn't turn to Jesus for a justification of that, that there would be some dissonance or distance between those two. So for the just war traditions of Christian faith to emerge and to take precedence, several things had to happen. They had to give some accounting of these rather straightforward, or at least seemingly straightforward, texts that run in the direction of nonviolence, particularly Matthew 5 and Romans 12. Our old friend Thomas Aquinas said that these texts are what he called counsels of perfection. So all the commandments in the gospel for things like chastity and celibacy, poverty, give all your stuff away, and nonviolence, those are counsels of perfection that apply only to clergy, to priests, to monks, to nuns. The rest of us are under a lesser standard. So priests can't kill. Priests can't marry, have sex, have children. Priests should take vows of poverty. Don't know how they're doing with that one. If you look at the Vatican, it looks pretty posh. But the laity, the rest of us, we go on about our business of making money, making babies, and making war. So it's a division of moral labor was one way, a very predominant one in the Roman Catholic Church. Others have said later in history that the New Testament is a world of apocalyptic imminence. They think the kingdom of God is coming in 15 minutes and that Jesus will be back in 2 weeks. Inside of that imaginative expectation, it makes sense to have a radical ethic. Don't get married, don't have kids, don't have money, don't fight. But as time drags on some 2,000 years, that's less plausible. Along these same lines, some have said that this is the marginal ethic of survival for a persecuted minority. When the head of your religion and indeed your God is put to death by the empire, when the empire at best is indifferent and usually is hostile and sometimes violently hostile to you and your religion, it's best to stay out of the way. You are not part of the power structure. The power structure is in fact arrayed against you. So withdraw yourself from it. In addition to these temporal and contextual factors, others say that the ethic of Jesus in Matthew 5 and 7 is personal. If you punch me, I turn the other cheek. I don't avenge myself against you. I go the extra mile and so on and so forth. But that's not what we do in our social relationships. The pointed way to say it is it's one thing for me to turn my cheek to my attacker. It's another thing for me to turn your cheek to your attacker. So in our social relationships, we do stand up for the weak and the innocent against the powerful and dominative. Augustine, who we'll see in a minute, is the father of just war theology, said what's prohibited is self-defense. I can't defend myself, but I must defend my neighbor. So I don't strike back when I'm struck, but if I see you strike him, I step in. I resist, and if need be, you know, forcefully resist you. Reinhold Niebuhr, who is one of the most influential ethicists of the last century, said that this ethic of love is an impossible ideal. It's simply impracticable. It shows us just how short we fall of God's intention. It makes us work even harder for justice because we know love's impossible. Nigel Bigger, who we mentioned a moment ago, says that in the New Testament, Jesus has a very particular form of violence in mind, namely the nationalist revolutionary violence of the Maccabees and the Zealots. So what he's rejecting is the violent insurrection of the Jews against the Roman occupiers, not violence in general. Finally, and perhaps most influentially, besides Aquinas and Augustine, Martin Luther put forward two theological doctrines. The first is what we call law and gospel. That doesn't break down as Old Testament and New, but rather texts that are commands and texts that offer grace. Those commanding texts, those rules and laws, serve only for Luther a negative purpose. They convict us of our sin, they bring us to our knees, and they take us to the cross to receive forgiveness. They're not meant to be models for conduct. His second doctrine, shared by Calvin and others in the Reformed tradition, is called the two kingdoms. In the temporal realm, state, public life, economy, so on and so forth, the law of the land is justice. In the spiritual kingdom, the church, other places, the law is love. So there's again a division of labor, not between clergy and laity, but between basically personal private life, public political life. What do you make of these accounts of those texts that might lead us in the direction of nonviolence and pacifism? Do any of them strike you as plausible? Do all of them taken together add up to a plausible loophole through which we can wriggle to avoid the seeming stricture of loving your enemy and turning the other cheek? Seeing some nodding heads. Is it one in particular, or is it sort of the package of them all together? The package? First, wait, pretend in the microphone. One more. There you go.
The two commandments, love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself, which is obviously quite a challenge if you have a conflict.
But... Sure. Okay.
I have a problem of thinking philosophically and then thinking like a lawyer. It's like a lawyer, you always defend yourself. You defend the defenseless. To not defend them is negligence.
Okay.
Philosophically, that's where my problem comes in. Jesus seems to provide an impossible choice. If you're going to follow me, you don't do violence. I like Augustine's idea about defending your children, your family. I don't think Jesus would be against that. But I don't think these are simple questions that we have to struggle with. We're embedded in human life as it is. We see things that are wrong. We want to right them. And sometimes to right them means to fight them. I said, being a Christian is a real challenge, philosophically and in every respect, in the way you act. But to watch someone abuse someone else and not to step in there and protect, I cannot do. I cannot not act. Now, if it comes to war, which involves my killing others that I consider bad, that's the difficult thing. Would I do that? Would I go and shoot somebody else and kill them? That's where I don't see Jesus carrying a rifle and killing somebody.
Yep. This is tough stuff. You'll note the prominence of the words conflicted and contested in the introduction. So just war thinking as we now know it begins with our old friend Augustine in the 4th century. He was an African bishop and before bishop priest who wrote quite a lot, both in his formal theological writings, but more importantly for our purposes in letters and sermons that have come down to us through history. We can talk about a theory of just war, a theology of just war, traditions of just war thinking, but we need to remember that those things took some 1,200 years to develop into what we now know and what we'll see in just a minute. They began with Augustine's ad hoc informal pastoral interventions. He had people who he knew personally and familiarly, and people who wrote to him saying, "Hey, my name's Boniface. I'm a centurion. I was just baptized. Do I need to lay down my sword?" And Augustine said in these letters and sermons, "No, you do not." And he worked out some of the things that we saw just a moment ago, namely the distinction between self-defense and defense of the innocent neighbor. So just war thinking begins with the practical and pastoral theology of Augustine in the 4th century. Over time, these ideas get worked out into full-blown theories and theologies that we'll see here in just a moment. They're developed mostly by our other friend, Thomas Aquinas, who first distinguishes between killing and murder. In our terms, killing is description. It's the termination of a human life by another human person. Murder, then, is evaluation of a termination as unjust. War functions both descriptively and evaluatively. To say war puts us in the realm of political violence. It's not me versus you, it's us versus them. I'm not killing you because we have beef or because I'm, trying to get something and you're in my way. So it's neither criminal nor personal killing. It's killing in the realm of the political. And as evaluation, war is potentially and in principle just and justified killing in armed combat. The paradigmatic instance of just and justified killing is self-defense. You attack me or attack someone next to me, I defend myself and resist, you die. Same for nations. The paradigmatic instance of just war is self-defense or proxy defense of a third party. Hitler invades, eventually the United States, England, France band together and resist. How then do we evaluate if any particular instance of killing in warfare is not just potentially and in principle just, but is actually so? Following and developing Augustine, Aquinas lays out two sets of criteria. The first are what we now call the jus ad bellum, that is justice in resort to war, what we might call the right to fight. How do you know when war is appropriate? How do you know when it's justified? There are seven canonical jus ad bellum criteria. First and foremost, number one answer on the board is you must have a just cause. You can't do it just because you think the Canadians are a little bit snotty. You have to have a good reason. Paradigmatically, self-defense or proxy defense of a third party, but otherwise a conspicuous, that is big and obvious, and grievous, that is very, very bad, injury of justice. You have to have a prominent injustice that needs to be corrected to even consider resorting to war. Second, you have to have a legitimate, sometimes called a competent authority. We can't just get together, go shake down Jeff Bezos for a few billion dollars, buy some tanks and planes, and roll into Mexico because we want to take over. It's only official, legitimate governmental authorities that are authorized to exercise this kind of political violence. Third, you have to have right, sometimes called upright intention, namely, the restoration of whatever order, justice, and peace have been violated by the grievous wrong. Part of having right intention is being willing to use right means. Right means include knowing whether or not you have a reasonable probability of success. This one was interesting in the case of Ukraine, because everybody except the Ukrainians didn't think they had a reasonable probability of success. Early on, we recommended that they sue for peace, that they make some kind of compromise with Russia and Putin. We were slow in sending them aid and arms. But lo and behold, they've been reasonably successful, not in defending their entire country, but at least limiting the incursion. Next is proportionality. And here, proportionality is at the macro scale. Remember, action is ends and means. Warfare is a means, and it is a terrible, torturous, and damaging means. If you're going to resort to these means, you best have ends that are worth it. So you have to ask, will the justice that is restored, will the order that is reinstated, will the peace that comes on the backside of all this bad stuff be worth it? And if it's not, you should try something else. Last but not least, war is meant to be a final straw, not a first thought. Last resort, sometimes called last reasonable resort. It doesn't mean you have to try everything you can possibly think of. We can't call up Zelensky and say, hey, did you send Putin a puppy? Did you try that? But you have to try the usual means, negotiation, sanction, mediation by international bodies. War is meant to be a necessary means. It's the only way we can accomplish these ends that we can't forsake. Together, these criteria spell out the conditions and situations in which war is morally, politically, and legally valid, as well as practically necessary. So once we've decided that we have the right to fight, that warfare is indeed justified, how do we go about that? The second set of criteria are called the jus in bello criteria, justice in war, justice in fighting, what we might simply call fighting rightly. Here there are only two. First, proportionality again, not at the macro scale of ends and means, but rather at the level of discrete actions and military operations. Is the force used here proportionate to the military objectives we're seeking? And second, and this is the one that's hardest, is discrimination, also known as non-combatant immunity. Now, when just war was first formulated in the ancient era and in the medieval era, war was usually people on horses with lances, maybe with bows and crossbows, and they were out on a field facing off against each other. It was easier to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, although even in those worlds, there were sieges of cities. Modern warfare, our weapons are exponentially more destructive, and most of our fighting takes place in populated areas. It's a lot harder to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, between civilians and soldiers. Here, the idea is that we use only as much force as is necessary. Don't bomb where bullets would do. Don't bomb a whole city when a targeted strike would work. Don't occupy when invasion, pacification, and withdrawal would work. Taken together, these two sets of criteria intend to restrict when war happens and how, to make it less frequent and less violent, to limit the force that is used in war and to delimit it as best we can, such that force does not harm civilians. Let's look at a couple of quick examples to maybe put this on its feet. Imagine you're all factory workers in World War II. You work in an automotive plant. Hostilities ensue between your nation and another. Because you're auto workers making automobiles, you enjoy non-combatant immunity. You have civilian status, both at work on the factory floor and at home with your families. Railroad lines and other infrastructure like that are fair targets because they can be used in the war effort. But the enemy may not bomb passenger terminals or passenger trains. They can perhaps bomb a bridge, but they do best to bomb the railways out somewhere where there are not a lot of people around. Imagine hostilities escalate, the war drags on, and your factory is converted from an automotive factory to a tank factory. This means now that the factory itself is a legitimate military target, as is the rail terminal right next door where the tanks will be loaded and sent to the front, and that when you're in the factory making tanks, you're now a legitimate target as well. You're not an auto worker anymore, you're a munitions worker. You lose your civilian status and forfeit your non-combatant immunity. But only when you're on the clock and on the assembly line, when you're materially involved in the hostilities by producing armaments. As soon as you cross those tracks and go home, you revert to civilian status and regain your non-combatant immunity. Notice, however, the proximity of the factory, the rail lines, and your housing means that bombing legitimate targets, the factory and the rail lines next door, may miss and hit houses, or may cause fires that spread. This is what we call collateral damage, the unintended civilian casualties. Though foreseen as possible, or maybe even likely, just war generally does not regard these kinds of deaths as murder. But if we're being honest and realistic, even smart bombs go off target, and even when they hit their targets, munitions explode, fires spread, and civilian casualties are often unavoidable. In fact, in modern warfare, civilians die at somewhere between a rate of 3-1 or 2-1 to combatants. Modern warfare is, by definition, indiscriminate in a certain respect. Now imagine that the factory and the railways are heavily fortified and well defended. They have multiple anti-aircraft guns or surface-to-air missiles. Imagine also that you and your fellow factory workers don't live across the way from the railroad tracks, but you live all the way across town in a separate neighborhood. Neither the impossibility or improbability of a successful attack on the factory, nor the likely loss of planes and pilots would justify your enemy in attacking you in your homes as a different way of preventing the production of tanks. Because again, when you're in your home, you're a civilian. You're not a party to the hostilities because you're not making tanks. Now let's consider one final complication. Suppose that rather than living in private homes in a residential neighborhood across the tracks from the factory, you workers and your families are quartered in dormitories on the factory grounds, perhaps a separate high-rise apartment, or maybe just a different floor in the factory, but the same building. What now? Now that you're experts in just war thinking, what happens when the civilians and the military targets are so commingled that they can't be discriminated? That to bomb the factory where the tanks are made is to bomb the families of the workers who make them. What do you reckon? Thoughts, guesses, worries?
Isn't that when we give notice?
Sure, you can do things like that. You can say, hey, y'all, in about, you know, 2 days, we're coming through. Please, you know, please disperse. What else? This is a tough one.
My answer would be you have a mess and people rationalize whatever is convenient for them. And there I would say, you know, just take a look at the disagreements about what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah. So this example is meant to sort of structurally mirror some of that. I know that's a lot. I said we would be broad outlining, rough sketching, skimming the surface, but we have a few minutes here at the end, and I'm happy to stay longer if anybody wants to chat. What do you make of all of this?
I'm not going to get into that one. But before are you going to be talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer at some point in the choice he made?
I hadn't planned on it.
Huh?
I hadn't planned on it.
Could you put that on your list? Because that's a tough one.
So how many have heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Yes, no? Okay, so you know, so he was a Lutheran priest and theologian. He wound up running, he was involved in the Confessing Church movement, which was the German Protestant Christians who were resisting the Nazification of a state church, a Reichskirche. So Hitler Nazified everything. The German word is Gleichschaltung, literally shifting into the same gear. So you're no longer a member of the United Auto Workers, you're now a member of the National Socialist Auto Workers. You're no longer a member of the Boy Scouts, you're a member of the Hitler Youth. So everything in Nazi Germany was being brought into the orbit and under the authority of the Nazi Party. This is what we mean by totalitarianism. Everything from top to bottom was Nazified and politicized, including the church. Some of the Protestant Christians, including Bonhoeffer and others, said, hell no, we're not doing this. They wrote confessions and public statements. They formed a separate institution, including underground seminaries, which Bonhoeffer famously was sort of the dean of. His seminary moved 6 or 7 times because the Nazis kept finding out where it was. He was sort of always one step ahead of the law. And eventually, his brother-in-law was in the Abwehr, the German version, basically, of the CIA. He gets Bonhoeffer sort of a make-work job in the Abwehr, sort of as a cover, which would allow him also to travel outside of Germany and report to the wider Christian community what was going on. Through that connection, Bonhoeffer gets drawn into the Stauffenberg plot, the plot to kill Hitler that failed, where they, you know, put the bomb under the conference table at the Wolf's Lair, but the table was so big and so heavy that it absorbed the blast. Hitler lived. Bonhoeffer eventually winds up in a prison camp, gets hung and executed just a few days before the camp's liberated. But in his writings, and this is, I think, where you were going, he weighs his conscience. He was a committed pacifist. He thought the love your enemy stuff was real. He tried to live up to it, but he found himself in circumstances where that was, to him, impossible. So he participated, albeit peripherally, in this plot. But he thought that should the plot succeed and should the war end, he would have to renounce his ordination, that he would have sinned in such a way that he thought was necessary, but that would exclude him from further ordained ministry. So it's a sort of paradoxical, you know, I know what I'm doing is wrong, but I feel like I can't do anything else, which really captures some of the tragedy of these dynamics.
And with that, I'm going to have to stop the recording and bolt, but welcome people to stay and discuss.
Thanks, everybody.